We're like an obese teenager addicted to crack. We need something like 7 or 8 times the historical volume of copper that's ever been mined for the last 4,000 years in the next 25 years just to stand still. The human species at large is now required to look at itself in the mirror, and it cannot dodge these things anymore.
Have there any governments been able to verify the conclusions that you draw from the work you've done?
So, first of all,
welcome to Radius of Reason, a podcast about the greatest problems facing humanity. I'm Levon, here with my co-host, Andre.
Hey, everybody. Our guest on today's episode is Dr. Simon Michaud. He's an associate professor at the Geological Survey of Finland, with work really focusing on the potential limitations to the green energy transition.
Now, if you're already familiar with his work, in this episode, we go beyond the usual discussions on mineral scarcity to explore deeper civilizational shifts required for a sustainable energy future.
Of course, not everybody agrees with Dr. Michaud's conclusions. In fact, his research has a fair amount of criticism. We wanted to give Dr. Michaud the opportunity to address some of these claims, as well as to get into some of our own critiques of his work.
And with that, here is Dr. Simon Michaud.
When we're planning stuff for the future, we should be looking at natural resources, what they are, where do we get them from, and over what time frame. And once we actually understand that, it's fine. We can move on and do something else.
Now, but isn't some of the criticism of your work related to even the estimates of, you know, reserves,
yep,
of these mineral reserves? So, I mean, what do you say about that? Because that should be more or less fixed if we're confident in those estimates to begin with.
So what I did was I just got the best information I could get from the U.S. Geological Survey.
Mm-hmm.
And I just quoted their numbers. And it says, at this year, these are the reserves and these are the resources. What I think the criticism is we can always go and discover more. Right? I presented these numbers as if they were fixed, but no, we can discover more. So my point to that is, as someone from the mining industry, is it takes time to do such things. Between 5 and 20 years to find get drilling permits to go out and discover a deposit which could then become a resource. But to take that resource to a state of reserve involves a pre-feasibility study. That's 7 or 8 years, usually more drilling and more geostatistics and everything. But then to take a stated mineral reserve and turn it into a producing mine, then you've got anywhere between 15 and 20 years. Now, there are exceptions to this. Like in Australia, there's a lithium mine. They went from absolutely nothing to a producing mine in 12 months. So there are everything we look at, there are exceptions. But generally, mining, to get a mine going, to go from nothing to a producing mine, we're talking a couple of decades.
Right. And then you have to, and then you've got to refine the materials, and then you've got to produce the necessary materials to then build the you know, power plants. So what is, you know, what's a realistic range from the time that you identify a deposit to using materials, you know, mined from that deposit in a power plant that's up and running? Like, what's a realistic time frame?
Well, so how long's a piece of string? But as a rough average, 25 to 30 years, something like that. And it also depends on what resource you're talking about. So the idea that a lot of the I did the first study of its kind that first of all went from bottom up. How many units do we have on the ground? How many do we need? What metals would be in them, sum it all together, and then put that up against, well, this is what we have, what have we got, right? And the only numbers we have of what have we got is reported reserves, reported resources. And yes, they're static numbers, but it's the only thing we've got. And if there's a shortfall, then we should look at that shortfall and problem solve around it. Now, we can say we can go off and find more metals, but we're pulling more metal out of the ground than we've ever done before, ever. So, and to think that we are going to multiply that by 10 or whatever it's going to be, and to do that in a short 25 years?
Hey, everybody. We hope you're enjoying the conversation with Dr. Michaud. If you want to support this channel, please be sure to give this video a like and subscribe.
And of course, drop a comment. Let us know what you think.
So there's practical restraints there that the people who criticize my work don't seem to get. And they're coming from several sectors. But the resources, yes, we can go and find more resources. Do we really think, okay, a good one is between 2020 and in the and 4000 BC, like, so for the past 4000 years, 42,000 years, whatever, the human race mined 700 million tons of copper. Right. Demand is as it is now that we will do the same thing in the next 22 years. As in, demand is going up and we're producing so much every year. Now, my numbers that I put together, and yes, it's not a perfect calculation, that is understood, but it's a calculation and there is nothing else like there out there that does the same things. So if we take the 28-day buffer, and that's one of the points that, that people get very angry about, 28 days, we need 6.1 billion tons of copper.
Explain to people listening, when you say buffer, you're talking about the intermittency of things like solar and wind.
Wind and solar are highly intermittent, and they do the you've got the day-night cycle, but you've also got the seasonal cycle. Like in winter, for example, the sun isn't as strong or useful as wind as it is in summer, and so for 5-6 months of the year, solar panels underperform. And if we've now got the entire grid is now solar and wind, whereas at the moment it's just buffered up against fossil fuels. So if we need more power, we just burn more fossil fuels. But if it's all coming from solar and wind now, there are periods of the year that we need capacity from somewhere else. Right, and the original study was, well, that'll have to come from a buffer. Or a new idea that's now sort of been come up and is in the process of being tested, can wind buffer solar and can solar buffer wind? And there's problems with that too. But the buffer is we need to have the same amount of power delivered, you know, to meet demand, right? And if a massive chunk of our power grid suddenly doesn't perform very well because it's, you know, it's winter and we don't get the sun radiance anymore, we need power from somewhere else.
What could you not? Could you not just have solar energy held on reserve, things you've already powered?
How do you do that? What are you talking about there? You're talking about a buffer.
yeah, but they have systems in place where, I mean, I'm not an engineer, but there's a contraption where there's a tank of water and then there's like a pump that moves the water down and it releases the energy that's stored.
Yes, correct. You're talking about a long-term storage.
Yes.
Is it pumped hydro? Is it hydrogen? Is it a battery bank? Is it spinning flywheels? Is it students and hamster wheels?
I was going to say, did you do any calculations for how much material is required for hamster wheels? Like if we just powered the entire society with hamsters?
I think that calculation could backfire spectacularly when my boss sits me down and asks me, what did I do and why? No, I haven't done that. What you're talking about there is power has to be stored somewhere else and then brought in.
Right.
And those storage mechanisms in their own right have efficiency metrics.
Issues.
And issues. And I tried to look as many of them as I could. But then remember, this was done back in 2021. And here we are, you know, things have moved since then. This is the other problem. It took 2.5 years to get this through peer review. Whereas my critics can pull up stuff that was developed yesterday. So, and this is the problem of actually trying to do this. What's interesting, though, is the fundamental learnings that came out of my work still hold. We've still got the basic idea. So back to what we were saying before, right? 770 million tons has been mined over the last 4,000 years. Okay, great. And we're going to, keep up with existing demand because our economies must expand and all that. We're going to do the same thing in 22 years. Right, but if we're going to actually produce, take out the entire fossil fuel system, which is the most complex technology system the world has ever known, and replace it with something else, we're going to talk about a massive spike in resources of all kinds. You know, for example, how much cement do you think you're going to need if we're going to have to do this? And that wasn't part of the calculation. How much steel? That wasn't part of the calculation. I only went for like a tiny part of it, really. Anyway, so 6.1 billion tons of copper. Now, the storage that I've used there is battery banks, because when I looked at all the different storage types, All the other ones had logistical issues and problems, including battery banks, but battery banks have a resource problem. The reason I picked that one is every politician I've spoken to around the world when I was looking at this believed battery banks was the thing. Battery banks was what they were going to authorize. That's what they were going to make money off. So battery banks went in. And so it showed the scale of the problem. So anyway, so what that's basically saying is we need something like 7 or 8 times the historical volume of copper that's ever been mined for the last 4,000 years in the next 25 years just to stand still as we were in 2018. There are fundamental problems with that. As in, go back to the drawing board, think of something else, guys.
How do those estimates relate to population dynamics moving forward? You know, the population should, in theory, plateau over the next decade or two and then drop significantly. But also the demographics are going to be very different, where you got a higher ratio of older people. And so what does that do to your labor force that's required to build all these mines and power plants and so on?
So that's actually another can of worms that actually was outside of the scope of my work. What I did was I took what was industrially reported in terms of physical activity in the year 2018. And I says, if we were to phase out all fossil fuels and replace it with entirely non-fossil fuel systems, what would it look like? There's no discussion of population there at all. It was like a snapshot in time. Now, between 2018 and 2050, the IEA predicted that the electricity would increase by, is it 3 times? Like the amount of electricity we would need would be 3 times. Our transportation fleet, our cars, that's 2.4 times the size. Right, like they're predicting growth. They're predicting growth. Now, even in their predictions, they didn't take on things like population dynamics, a couple of years ago, everyone was worried about overpopulation, but now things like fertility rates have come in and things are crashing, and especially in the developed world, we've been declining for some time. And so, but the phrase again, and this is actually very important in the sort of work I do. How you state a problem is about half of the work to do to solve that problem. And so, what I also say, what is being harvested from the natural environment on planet Earth on behalf of humanity at large far exceeds the planet's ability to replenish those sustainable natural resources or finite non-renewable natural resources. What we're stripping out of the planetary environment on a day-to-day basis is huge. Compared to per person now to, say, 500 years ago, what are we pulling out of the environment? And that's the problem. So the number of people telescopes that number, but what the real problem is, what resources do we consume per person and why?
Hey guys, hope you're enjoying the show. Just a quick reminder to like and subscribe.
And drop us a comment. Let us know what you think about this episode.
And the why is when you untangle stuff and you think, why do we do this stuff? You know, like a lot of it's really sort of wasteful. They say, well, it makes us money. Okay, what's money? Numbers on a screen. philosophically.
It's a very good question because we had an anthropologist on that had lived with hunter-gatherers for, about 15 years. And there's also studies that back this up. But basically, he noticed that they're just happier than people in the developed world. And it's like, it's a genuine question as to why do we need all this shit? But we're as a culture, I don't think we're sophisticated enough right now to handle those questions.
I don't know if it's a cultural thing. I think you can ask each other that on an individual basis as much as you want, but it's a systemic issue. You have an economic model that effectively promotes and pushes this kind of way of living. I don't think it's an individual.
Economy, culture, they're all feedback loops.
Drop in a Bill Hicks quote. Look at the furrows of worry on my forehead. Look at the numbers on my back. I actually have given some thought to that because in evolving what we call the circular economy into the resource balanced economy, this is like something else, that the question of what resources do we consume and why has been given some serious thought. And what I've come to the conclusion is we're on the cusp of a change that happens every couple of centuries. Like, so let's go back to, say, the 16th century. All the conflicts were revolved around which religious code was best, you know, Protestant or Catholic. Now, this is in Europe. This is Europe-centric. Right. Then what we call science manifested, merged with philosophy, and changed the world, the Age of Reason. A couple of centuries later, what we call engineering manifests, merges with money, and the world changes. And neoclassical economics starts up at that point too. Now, neoclassic economics is not about the value of something that's the value of something is not about what it took to make that product. That's your classical economics. But neoclassic is the perception of the value. If I can convince you this is more valuable than it is, but you give me the money, then it's all good, right? So then we've got the idea of let's go off and get rich. And in the beginning, if you read, for example, Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, and they're talking about, well, we don't care about things like ethics or human being, you know, suffering or everything. As long as we get rich, we make you rich too. That turned out to be bullshit. But in fact, people doing selfish things to get rich is the objective, or criminals take over. Look around. Yeah, the invisible hand brought us to this point. My point is, a lot of the challenges we face now are outside the paradigm of original neoclassical economics. Neoclassical economics is failing. It cannot tell the difference between a natural capital, a human-made capital, and a waste product that is environmental impact. It sees all of that as economic progress, right? And it doesn't cost out the true cost of things. Like, it hides things like environmental pollution. It hides things like social impacts. And so, yeah, that's not my problem. Right, so what I think is happening is we're on the cusp of a new era. And that new era, neoclassical economics will break down and some kind of ecological economics will take its place in some form. Right, and what I would...
Do you really think that? Because it seems like that would necessitate some form of stability geopolitically, and we're far from that, trending in the wrong direction.
Let me finish. So you're talking about a transitionary period, and that transitionary period where everyone eats each other doesn't go on forever. So we're talking about a transitionary period. And I'm not proposing something that will happen. We all see the light and suddenly we all just ride off into the sunset together and everything's fine. But what are the boundary conditions we're walking into? Now, when we had the phrase at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, engineering manifests, merges with money and changes the world. What happens now? And I think it's going to be something like true situation awareness happens for society at large, merge with the understanding of what is illusion and what is real. Because if you think about how much of our world at the moment is based on illusion, even our money systems, where we just print money, it's fine. Is it real? What's happening in the United States at the moment is they're now, the veil is starting to lift and they're starting to see how much of it actually was illusion. And so there's a lot of people running around like headless chickens at the moment trying to manage the situation. And it's going to end badly. But what we're talking about is when everyone understands this, and yes, there's going to be more disruption and volatility than we've ever seen before, ever. I don't think it's going to be to the point where we're organized enough to go to war with each other in like World War II, because we had two big factions, two huge factions that were organized in their own choice. No, it's going to be it's going to be quite disruptive on a small scale, and nothing's going to work for a while. And in that chrysalis of chaos, some of us, not everyone, some of us will have to work out a way, how do we live and how do we operate in a way that's authentic, in a way that it can be trusted. We say what we mean what we say, and we don't have to be questioned once it's done. How do we do that? What we want, what we need, what we do become the same thing. How do we do that? And that's not for everyone, because everyone's, well, chaos is fun. You know, this is a pattern we know about. you know, let's go and, you know, break shit and set fire to stuff. And, you know, we know how to do that. It's fine. But right. And so we're talking about an era of that. And in that chaos, some parts of the world will stabilize to a new equilibrium. What is that equilibrium? And eventually, the parts of the world that are in chaos will realize that chaos is not sustainable for very long, and they have to actually settle in on a new system. And so there's going to be like the wild, wild west of ideas of new stuff being tried, then breaking down, tried, then breaking down, till they find some combination that works, whatever that is. Now, I can put some ideas out there, but it's almost guaranteed that something else will happen.
Yeah, it's an interesting scenario that you're trying to paint there. I like to think the reason we've had all this prosperity, material prosperity, you could say, over the last, you know, century or two, is because the global, like, game theory dynamics have changed to become like non-zero sum, because simply the growth itself creates like a non-zero sum dynamic. But that's, you know, that was always based on finite resources. And once you start hitting those boundaries, now it goes back to a zero-sum game. So I think we're going to revert back to default human nature, which is taking shit from other people.
Yep. Yep.
So I
call that the Viking mentality.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, you know, different areas of the world have different resources. We're now accustomed to certain standards of living that require various resources from around the world. So it's hard to imagine whoever the next superpower is, whether that remains the US or someone else, even in a period of decline and then a transition back to, or an attempt to go back to some sort of stable state. It's hard to imagine they're going to leave, you know, those regions that have the resources they want alone. So there always seems like there's going to be some tension there. Yep. I don't know.
So it's like dealing with if you were to model the entire human species as a single individual, this is an interesting exercise. You go through the histories, everything. Our current era, we're like an obese teenager addicted to crack. And we're trying to tell.
I'm definitely using that. I'm using that in the intro.
Yeah.
And so an obese teenager addicted to crack, and we're telling that teenager to kick the habit and lose some weight. And they would look at why, but it's fun.
Crack feels good. Yeah.
As in, that's too much hard work. Why would I do that? And so while we are pushing in a particular direction, this is what we have to work with. But as long as we're not given a choice to grow up, we won't. Human nature will always take the easiest way out. It's human nature. So what if we're put in a position where all the easy way outs, well, they're not so easy anymore? And more importantly, if we're put in a position where what we do is mirrored back to us, we can't avoid seeing it anymore. Because the entire last two centuries has been, we've been doing stuff, but the consequences of our actions, we've been able to sort of, you know, push off to one side and not see. We didn't like if the voting public actually understood what was done on their behalf in other countries, would they allow it?
The voting public of which
any given nation?
Is Finland doing to the world? Like what are they what are they involved in?
No, they're promoting the culture of saunas everywhere. and phrases like "Be happy, you bastard." No, they're not doing that. But things like let's say you were citizens in, say, Great Britain, in say 1900 or 1850 or something, and in the British Empire, our boys in red are in, and the redcoats are going across the world and expanding the empire and making it great. Yes, wonderful. Wow. But if they actually understood the consequences to the people who are subject to that. And they actually understood what that meant, you know, conquest and all the things that come with that. Would those public be okay with that? Because it would how do they see themselves? They had this insular way of seeing themselves, right?
And wasn't the issue they saw themselves inherently superior to the people they were conquering?
While they were allowed to. But what if they're put in a position where they can't do that anymore? The problems that we are facing now are for everyone. The solutions that we think we're putting on the ground are impacting people in ways that we now can't avoid seeing. And now we're coming back to the understanding is a lot of it comes down to our own choice. We're a democracy, remember, right? And so the human species at large is now required to look at itself in the mirror, and it cannot dodge these things anymore. And that's the learning. We are in the process of growing up.
I think we might find a way to surprise you, Sam.
No doubt. No doubt. But the ultimate outcome is what?
You know, doom. You
know, yes. Yeah, so surprise.
This is a doomer podcast.
No, it is not. No, no.
But so we will have all human. I like to say the phrase, individuals may surprise you. Organized institutions like government will not. Right. And so we will see the most asinine behavior. Yeah, and we're seeing it now, but we sort of are taking it on like it's not really our problem. But there comes a point when it is our problem because our daily lives are being affected in some form. And they can wriggle around and duck and weave and try and evade, but there will come a point when that doesn't work anymore. And usually what they do is they start a good old-fashioned war to distract people. But what's happened now is two things. One, most of the people in the world are now educated at levels never been seen before, men and women, right? We've never seen education at such levels. Second is we've got information transfer happening where something can happen in Canada and a few minutes later I can hear about it in Finland. And there are strategies put on the ground to try and corrupt that. You know, things like fake news and everything, but humanity is now evolving in a consciousness way and discernment of understanding what's bullshit and what's not. And this is not something that is going to happen next week, but over the next few years, all the leaderships around the world, they're going to be called out by their own populations. That is bullshit. We ain't having this anymore.
Well, if their standard of living is affected, then maybe. But I think let's get back on track with the resource availability issue. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if the calculations that you've done factor in standard of living, and because you know because most of the world isn't living according to the West's standards, and if they were to that probably blows up the calculations even further.
Yes, actually, there was a calculation I did where in the 2021 report where if oil use per capita is a proxy for standard of living, it was a proxy, and most of the world. If everyone in the world per capita was to live the same way as, say, people in Germany in the year 2018, in Europe, just Germany, if everyone in the world had the same standard of living, they would consume the same amount of oil per capita. Now, remember, Germany's fairly well built up. They've got lots of communal transport. They lead the world in things like renewables and stuff. So they're ahead of most of the rest of the world. So what if the rest of the world came into line with Germany? And what I found was the oil consumption would massively expand. And in terms of daily production, we would have to find another 31 Saudi Arabian Gawa oil deposits to be operating to maintain that. And that's and with when you look at the oil discoveries, like what's been discovered year on year, that's never going to happen. Right. So what I basically showed there was the inequality that we see around the world at the moment. Is baked into the cake of how we operate at the moment, where we consume resources and why we consume resources, and what is the metric for success for our society. Now, is it Jacques Fresco, for example, had some very interesting ideas. Like I did some work with the Venus Project for a while, and Fresco had the idea that you could design a city based around the quality of life of the people in the city. Now, the metrics of what we do at the moment is economic value for a few people. Everyone else can just fuck off. So that's what I'm saying. We instead of trying to predict the future based on how things are now, that apple cart's about to be overturned in ways that's not been seen before. we're on the cusp of a really, really significant change, I think. And not just in what resources we use and how much or where we get them from, but why.
Mm.
That's all changing. Podcasts like this are a symptom of that. People are getting educated. Yeah. There's a hunger for this information. They want to know. It's going to be ugly.
Yeah,
we're going to see the stages of human evolution through why we do stuff, but people want to know. They want to
Some
have
people
want to
know. A small fraction of people are interested in knowing.
Precisely 650 people.
My point is podcasts like this, there's many of them around the world.
Right.
Why is Joe Rogan's podcast so successful, for example? People want to know. And ordinary people. I'm getting people as young as primary school age students coming after me and asking me questions about nuclear reactors. There is I work on the idea that we're individually conscious, but there's a group consciousness as well. And as a group, it's now politically correct or it's okay, acceptable to talk about certain things. And the conversation that you would have with a 12-year-old about nuclear reactors now is different to what it was 10 years ago on average. There's a rising tide of people want to know that the change is afoot. The idea of stand in the corner and we'll do your thinking for you.
Are you sure that's not your perception? Because you have, because of the internet, you have access to basically everyone in the world. And so you might seem like more people are, it might seem like to you more people are interested, more people are reaching out, but it's just merely a matter of just greater exposure. But, the ratio of people that are actually interested has remained constant. If anything, maybe it's declined because people rather be on TikTok or
TikTok is still a viable form of information, though. You could still proliferate knowledge about nuclear reactors on TikTok.
Fair point. But
surface level interest sometimes, so, though.
What happens when there's an undercurrent of fear and anxiety, right? Like 30, 40 years ago, people sort of felt, future was fine. You could do things like you could take on a housing loan for 30 years. But I talk to kids now.
I don't know with the threat of thermonuclear war, yeah. I don't know how optimistic people in Germany were, for instance, right? In the crosshairs of two superpowers.
So I talk to kids now every now and then, and they have no idea. I get questions like, what should I do? What career should I start up? What degrees should I chase? What work would be useful? There's this feeling that things are about to change, and the young very much are aware of that. Now, my comments on things are changing. In 2009, I stood up in front of a hostile audience and presented the idea of the implications of peak oil on the mining industry. Was at the time, the truck and shovel fleet and everything like that. This is, there will come a point when amount of mining will peak and then decline because it's based on energy. And at the time, I had no solution beyond fossil fuels that was viable. I was burned at the stake for heresy. Mm. Phrases like, you will never say this again, ever. Right. Those same groups now invite me formally to come and present at conferences. Right, so there is ideas that were considered unacceptable 20, 30 years ago and are perfectly acceptable in formal context. Like, how is it that someone like me can go and present at the United Nations conference on resources and say this stuff, right, and not get thrown out of the building, right?
Talk to us about that a little bit. You've talked with government officials behind the scenes. Yep. Share some of your experiences and what they seem to think the obstacles are and how they react to your work in private.
So there's the phrase I come back to is momentum. The system around us has a momentum. And as time has gone on, we've become more and more efficient, but in a very narrow window of efficiency. And everyone I've spoken to, not only their thinking, but what they're allowed to do, most politicians or most senior civil servants I come in contact with have a very narrow latitude of what they're allowed to do before they are replaced. Everyone,
perks of democracy, yeah.
Everyone reports to someone else, right? And it's not it's not a, we're not talking about a totalitarian political thing, is my job description is to do this with right. these metric targets. And the moment I start engaging in solutions you're suggesting, those metric targets are now overturned by something that we don't even understand.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, so what they would say, things like, there were three basic reactions I presented like a couple of hundred times between 2021 and 2024. And about a third of the time it was to government in some form, usually like some sort of working group, like civil servants. So every now and then I'd address politicians, like ministers. I presented to ministers in Australian Parliament, not on the Parliament floor, but I went to Parliament House in Australia and presented to about 30 ministers and their aides. And the reactions are as follows. First is shock. They says, fucking hell. Yeah, and they've got this expression on the face, you know, of a glassy-eyed stunned mullet. Now that's the graphic I use where, you know, of someone being smacked in the face with a dead fish. Mm-hmm. It's like that. And it says, because it is so cross purposes to what they have been told and raised on across their professional career. Second thing is when I come back and present like a second and third time, which often happened, they had my material, they had my Excel spreadsheets, and they were not able to refute what I was saying. So I presented again. And so when I presented like a second and third time, the final reaction was, and this was universal, what do we do? They were asking me what they should do. And at the time, I must say, it did piss me off. Because I'm just one guy with a cheap computer and an internet connection is able to do this piece of work. They've got a government department behind them with all their resources, and they've got military intelligence information that I don't. And they're asking me?
Have they been able to verify your research and or reproduce it? I mean, you've talked about in previous conversations you've had that, yeah, like the Department of Energy in the United States like ran the data that you collected. Like, have any governments been able to verify the conclusions that you draw from the work you've done?
So, first of all, it all comes down to the size of the buffer for wind and solar. And it was just wind and solar, whereas in reality, the whole system will need a small buffer because, you know, the way, you know, supply and demand balances out. So the Department of Energy in the United States took my work, and they said that actually now these guys have been fired with the Doge thing, so now I can actually tell you what actually went down. Well, no, that they told me stuff that was actually confidential because they're worried they're being fired, but now they're fired. So I can actually tell something went down. Right. So remember, where to start? Okay. They rang me up and they said, look, we've looked at your 2021 report, and my conclusions were very different to theirs. And they said that one of us is badly wrong. And I said, oh, here we go, the first spanking. But I said, all right, well, go away and check these, you know, seven or eight things. And I gave them a list of things to check. And, you know, basic things. And I said, you've got the information. And well, I think the list was how many cars were there in the transport fleet in the United States? They have that number. What distance did they travel in the calendar year? They have that number. All right. If each of those units was an electric vehicle or a hydrogen fuel cell, how much energy would they need to do the same physical activity? Okay, that's a straight calculation. Once they go from that, it goes, well, if they had that amount of energy, say, for an electric vehicle transport fleet to be charged off the grid,
mm-hmm.
how much power are we talking about? And so that they didn't have. And I said, but that's a straight calculation. Right. Or if it was hydrogen, you're going to make the hydrogen, but you're not allowed to use gas anymore, use electrolysis like you say. And they go, uh-huh. And then the next thing was wind and solar have a seasonal cycle.
Right.
They were based their entire things on net zero America. In fact, this is actually worth showing. Yeah, here we go. So I can, when this is read, I can show you something. So the entire United States was basing their future on what was called the Net Zero America Project. Now that project was, Let's see if I can do this. Share. Okay. Shazam! It works. Okay, can you see that?
Yes, we can.
Okay, yeah. So this is slide 16 or page 16 of the Net Zero America report. This was a very nice piece of work, incidentally. Like this, I would have been proud to be part of this project. Right, so what you've got here is this chart here. So this is over a 24-hour period, right? This is the top one's 24-hour period. You've got the amount of megawatts generated by the different systems. Now, you've got the day-night cycle. During the day, you have more power generated. During the night, you don't. But then you've actually got more power demand during the day and so on. The solid black line is demand, and demand and supply needs to marry up. Okay. So, and what they've done, the chart down the bottom here is days. So it's like 120 days. And so over the time, you've got 120 hours, over a couple of days. So you've got a couple of days here. And so sometimes supply exceeds demand. And when it does, they capture it and they store it. Every now and then, there's a peak in demand where it exceeds supply and there's a gap. So they store it and then they release it. And that's how they got their 5 to 7 hours of power storage buffer. Now, what I actually pointed out to the Department of Energy is follows. The yellow is renewable. So this is renewable. The storage they're talking about is this dotted blue section up the top here. Hold the phone. The dark blue, which is down here, is thermal. That's fossil fuel, burning of fossil fuels. So the whole Net Zero America project was based on the idea that fossil fuels will still be being burnt, and it will be most of the time, when you sort of see down the bottom here. So the idea of 5 to 7 hours was correct in that they were, what's the little gap here in between supply and demand? And that's it. They weren't talking about getting through a single night. 5 to 7 hours doesn't get us through a single night. Right. So.
So net zero is bullshit, is what you're saying?
All of these studies that they did, the job they set out to do. Right. They did exactly what they set out to do, which is why they passed peer review. But the job they set out to do has been used inappropriately. That's the problem. So that's the first thing that the Department of Energy, and they had an OODM moment. The second thing I pointed out was wind and solar perform, you know, across the seasons. Like in winter, summer doesn't, the wind doesn't actually work very well. In winter, solar doesn't work very well. And so if I could go back to, here we are. Okay. So share my screen. This is just I'm showing you single slides to actually sort of talk to a particular point. So screen. Okay. I'm hoping you can see that. Can you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is what the Department of Energy came back to me with. They said, right, we picked up our biggest grid, which is, you know,
the Northeast.
PJM RTO. It services 100 million people. They've got wind and solar. And they say, all right, okay. So across the full year of 2023, we did the same thing for 2022. And what they found was solar did indeed underperform for 6 months of the year during winter. And the ones that are colored are the ones that are problematic. Like it's what's below a problem. Wind underperformed for 4 months of the year. And it did it at the worst possible time. And so more power was being drawn off the fossil fuel grid to support this.
But hang on, this is also geographic specific. And this is a part of the United States that has very particular climate patterns during the winter.
Every region around the world is indeed different. Right. So, that's also another thing that doesn't come up very well. I did a case study in Hawaii where I actually looked at this directly. Here we are. Okay. So now I'm going to show you a case study in Hawaii. So every region's different, right? For example, Northern Europe has real problems with solar, and you've got things like solar panels covered in snow and all the rest of it. But you think Hawaii does pretty well, right? right?
You'd assume, yeah.
Okay, so this is what's coming in the Hawaii report. Why am I not? Okay, so, and boom. Okay, so this is Hawaii. So what we did was we took data actually measured in on the island of Oahu, and we had all these different kinds of solar panels because, you know, each one's different and they all have a different, you know, energy rating. And across the years, based on actual measurements, how productive would they be in terms of kilowatt hours per installed kilowatt? And so we came up with this. Well, if we had a grid of a certain size, it would produce this amount of power per month, as in what would it actually produce?
Mm-hmm.
And so they came up with this graph. That red line is what it would produce. Now, if that power grid was the only power system involved, and so there was no other power to, like, they're trying to phase out, they burn oil for electricity in Hawaii, so they're trying to phase it out. So to deliver power all the time, the dotted line would be the halfway point. Everything above the halfway point would be captured and stored, and it'll be put into the bits below that.
Yeah.
And what was found, there was a shortfall of almost 1 month, the equivalent of 28.8 days or 2.46.
Is that a technological limitation or an environmental limitation?
That, I suppose it's, well, the technology is vulnerable to the weather. So this is the weather. And this is the best technology had available at the time. And when we were actually looking at all the different kinds of things, like you've got rooftops on houses, rooftops on commercials, on top of parking spaces, fixed tilt ground mounts or single access trackers. You know, so is it? Well, I would say it's both. The technology itself is limited by the weather, and the weather is the environment.
And Simon, sorry, I need to take a big step back and just ask a question that we can get back to the point at hand.
Yep.
Why and how is the Geological Survey of Finland conducting this kind of research in Hawaii? Like how does that relationship work out?
I'll take that. Okay. So the way this work started in the first place is for 3 years before I came to Finland, I was in Belgium. And I was come from the Australian mining industry, and in the mining industry, mine stuff. We're very aware of mining stuff, resources, and we send it off to China and everything. But you come to Europe, none of that happens. Mining is dirty. Mining is unclean. We buy stuff off the market. But they're talking about critical raw materials.
Right.
And what
as they experienced with the war in Ukraine, all of a sudden their industries are...
This was back in 2008 when they started this. They're worried about certain businesses in Europe surviving, and they needed certain feedstock materials. And the elephant in the room was China was controlling most of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the problem. But they wouldn't talk about China. And that was very interesting.
Yeah.
well, it was considered taboo. There were a number of, like, we weren't allowed to talk about energy either. And that's why I wrote the oil report. I was specifically told you will not talk about energy. You know, you can't. You know, that's not, it was beyond our mandate. We talk about minerals. And again, right. So I sat down with my director general and science innovation officer at the time. This was 2018 when I first arrived there.
In Belgium.
Sorry. Let's go back a bit. In Belgium, I was learning recycling, industrial recycling and circular economy and all that. And the money ran out. I then got a job in Finland, Geological Survey. And as I landed, I was to develop ideas for the mineral intelligence project or the unit that they were putting together. And what was apparent to me was in Europe, there were all these blind spots. In fact, all this work that I wrote and everything was to address these blind spots. People were dictating terms and things that were going to end badly because they just weren't including the very basics. Come on, don't hurt me. Anyway, so when I was in Finland, GTK, Mineral Intelligence, I had sat down with lunch with my senior management. I got a napkin out. It has to be on a napkin. And on that napkin, I wrote out some basic numbers to show that if every car in the world became an electric vehicle, and everything was about batteries at the time, battery, and we used some very basic assumptions in what chemistries are used, and we will need this amount of cobalt, and I forget the number that was said, but, and then I said, well, Stated reserves and estimated resources of cobalt are a fraction of that. And so what I pointed out to my management that was, if we don't get in front of this, the captains of industry of Europe who are wanting to support European economy by making electric vehicle cars with batteries will turn to the geological surveys of Europe, GTK in particular, because we manage a battery portfolio. And they will ask the question, why didn't you warn us about this very basic problem of a mineral shortfall? Mm-hmm. And management looked at each other and said, yeah, okay, we probably should get ahead of this, shouldn't we? And so they said, go out there and write a series of reports that will discuss this. It doesn't matter, they said, even if it turns out I was wrong, you know, then you're just wrong. But if it was right, even if it was like not a very high profile publication, they had something to fall back on to say, we looked at
this.
We
did the digging, yeah.
We did the digging. We just didn't, the economics at the time, the momentum of the economics, they still won't fund research projects that are not lithium ion battery. Yeah, the momentum is still there. Right. So then we got talking about mineral demand, mineral intelligence. And I go, okay. Now, this is based on the idea that we have free markets and every market in the world is accessible to everyone else as long as you've got the money. Now, because I've been, like yourselves, I've been looking at these issues for some time, I knew there was a period that was coming where it's all going to break down. And here we are, tariffs, sanctions, and that's just the beginning. It's not going to be about who's got the money. It's who's got the materials and who's allied with who. I also was of the opinion that what we call the European Union was going to break up. Economic inequalities, they were printing money on a daily basis. Like it was mathematically inevitable that they were going to hit a point where the European Union would have to dissolve. And I pointed out that the only way to hold the European Union together is for something else. And I made the point, if Europe could actually cooperate in a way where it could exchange its own resources amongst itself, then that would be a reason for them to hold together. So you need an energy source, that's one, but you also need resources. And most of Europe has not been surveyed below 100 meters because they exported all mining.
And that was the original genesis of the European Union, was to have this connected economy of resource exchange.
Yeah, that was coal and steel. But yeah, they're proxies for everything else. So I made that idea, and the management looked at me and says, "What have you been smoking?" But they said, "Yeah, okay, fair enough." But then I proposed the idea that in that environment where Europe may be strained, if it did fragment, there'd be a new series of power blocks that would form in its place, and one of them I believe would be Nordia. So in Finland, if you've ever been to Finland or Sweden, they do things in a particular way, where the costs of operation are very expensive. Our costs are much higher than almost anyone else because we do business a particular way. They try and include everything into the cost, whereas other countries, they try and sort of, you know, throw some costs under the carpet and we'll deal with it later. And right. So what I saw was an industrial alliance, an alliance between industrial clusters in the countries of Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland. And by proxy, Greenland. Yeah, I know.
No. I'm just somewhere like Leif Erikson is just like, yes.
Well, it's logical. I'm not the first to think this, right? For example, if everything goes pear shaped, right, will the operators in Finland we've got a lot of smelters here and like a lot of industrial development. We're a highly educated population that's quite small, with industrial capability embedded in a pristine wilderness. And that combination, where else? Well, Norway and Sweden are the same, right? But everywhere else, we're not going to do business with, say, Italy or Greece. So that's a natural fault line.
The North-South divide, if you will.
Well, the way I say is the Viking Alliance. anyway.
But then the Northern Italians are going to say they're not just like the South, that, you know, they're Lombardians and whatnot. I mean,
and then they'll say something like, good luck with that, guys. come back to us when you've got something to trade with.
Oh, Christ.
Yes. Was it Australian pirates now operating out of Finnish waters? So, now, so then what would be needed to happen is to map in terms of assessment to phase out fossil fuels and phase in something else would have to be done for each of those countries. I did one for Finland. The plan was to do one for Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Iceland. Iceland is the key to making industry work because they've got so much geothermal, they make aluminium. Right, so if we're going to take away fossil fuels, what do we replace it with? The purple transition makes all this irrelevant because now any country can do it. Right, but at the time, geothermal was the thing. Now, my methods that I put together were new and no one else really sort of had done them before. I wanted to test these methods or at least develop these methods in a country far away from the Nordic frontier that had very different problems.
The Kingdom of Hawaii.
Well, Hawaii is... okay. All right, I'll be honest. Why Hawaii? I want to take my wife there on vacation. and why purple transition? Well, it's my wife's favorite color. Right. So when we get to Hawaii, because it's an island, it's an island chain, it's isolated. It's very easy to say this is one isolated system, whereas everywhere else in the world it's really hard to work out where the boundaries of any particular economy is because everything's so interconnected. Also, it's an island and it has geothermal potential. Iceland fits that profile. And I wanted to develop the ideas to a nice, robust level. So by the time I approached Iceland to do this work, certain things were already, because Iceland was the key to Nordia. Each country in the Nordic frontier, like Norway, has lots of hydrothermal, lots of hydropower, along its coastline. Sweden has lots of nuclear. Finland has lots of nuclear. You know, recycling capacity in Sweden is so efficient they've had to start importing waste from continental Europe. Both Norway and Denmark had oil and gas reserves that could keep us going while we implement the new system. Iceland had geothermal. There was a natural fit to all this. So then I approached some contacts I had in Hawaii and said, look, this is what I want to do. But anything about Hawaii should be led by Hawaiians. And so I hooked up with Peter Sternlich of Sustainable Hawaii. And he's the co-author of the report. And him and a few other people. So Hawaiians have been in there from the beginning, talking about mapping out what Hawaii is and what our options are, and if we would apply each option, what would it mean? You know, with locals leading the charge. And that's how we got to that point. The fundamental reason to be for all of this, all of it, what energy system do we use to phase out fossil fuels? Followed by what minerals do we need to resource that system and everything it supports? And if we knock out fossil fuels, but we also knock out wind and solar because they're not going to work, and batteries in their current form.
Cannot store effectively too.
And then what if we did batteries for something else? And that's also part of the conversation. What if we had an energy system that was able to do all this but didn't need such large amounts of minerals? And the minerals change. When we get to the solution end of things, when we can discuss what minerals change, what minerals should the Geological Survey of Finland be chasing? When Europe has its pants down moment and says, oh, God, we need to resource stuff ourselves, should they go out and set up a whole lot of lithium mines? The answer is no. So you've got to make the case for that. And so okay. This systems piece of work here. Do we need copper? Yes, probably not as much. What's the metal that we need most of? Iron, followed by nickel. So iron, nickel, copper. That trinity supports everything.
Hope you guys enjoyed the show. This is actually part one of our discussion with Simon. Part two will be coming out in a few weeks, where we explore his solution to the green energy transition, among other very interesting topics.
If you want to stay on top of all the episodes that we release, in addition to the upcoming follow-up with Dr. Michaud, please be sure to subscribe to our channel.